So what I've been thinking about lately is, I don't know if this will land on you like it's landed on me, but it's been very nice guiding principle for me lately. And it's an old Tibetan saying that is, when the heart is good, things work out okay. When the heart is good, things will work out okay. And I think that's just in that simple saying that just says so much about our practice. So simple. It's kind of like trust. Trust your open heart. So I'll return to that as I talk tonight. And I thought I'd talk, I don't know how far I'm going to get, but I thought I'd talk about these three vital principles of practice, the three vital points of practice. View, or cognition, having some cognitive grasp of Dharma. It's very important. We think we want to get rid of our thinking, but actually thinking, wise thinking, is the beginning and the middle and the end. We need to have a wise view. The second point is, when we have this wise view in mind, in big mind, we need to bring it into our experience. We need to bring it into our bodies. We need to bring it into our hearts through meditation. So meditation is the second point. So we can embody view, become familiar with it, familiarize ourselves with how this feels, this view, and become the view. And the third point is conduct. And meditation is the linchpin between view and conduct. Taking what we have learned cognitively, what we have embodied, what we know to be true now in our hearts and in our bodies, and taking it into the world with other people. So view. One view is the Four Noble Truths. It's the first thing that the Buddha taught. He didn't want to teach at all. He felt that what he had experienced was so inexpressible, so ungraspable, that he didn't think anybody could understand it. And there was no use trying to explain it. But he was urged on by the king of gods, Brahma, as the story goes, to please teach that some of the beings have just a little dust in their eyes and they can hear something. So he got up from the Bodhi tree. He walked 14 steps out. He turned around and he looked at the Bodhi tree, looked at where he'd been sitting all night. And who knows what went through his mind as he was looking at that tree. And then he turned around and he walked for months to Bodh Gaya. And what he when he was enlightened, he touched the earth and the earth shook. He brought this illumination to Bodh Gaya. And what he talked about was, he didn't say what it is. He talked about suffering. He said what it isn't. And the view begins with, it has four parts. The first part is that we suffer. This is noble truth. It is noble wisdom to know that we suffer. To feel our suffering. To know this is suffering. And we all, every one of us, have a longing not to suffer. It's foundational in every one of you. It's foundational in me. Every being wants to be free from suffering. Every being wants to be happy. That's why the Metta Sutra begins with those words, and how when we wish metta for others, we say, may you be happy, may you be free from suffering. And you may have the, may you have the causes of happiness, may you have the causes of freedom from suffering. But we need to know suffering to respond with this longing for freedom, to find our way. Suffering is a big word. Other words are dissatisfaction, frustration, disease, dis-ease, stress. But whatever it is, to be familiar with it. And the second noble truth is to understand the causes. It's like the suffering is, I'm a doctor here, my own doctor, knowing, seeing that I suffer. Is wisdom, then analyzing this disease. What's causing this disease? Investigating the disease before I can cure myself. I need to know the causes of the disease so I know what medicine to take. And the causes for the disease are described so beautifully in this scripture on the eight worldly winds, or the eight worldly vicissitudes, or the eight worldly concerns. I can't see all of you. I can only see six people. That, how many of you do not know about the eight worldly winds? Can you raise your hand and I'll flip around here? Okay, well, I see some people that don't. So I'll describe. it's a brilliant description of the causes of our suffering. So there are four pairs. Four pairs makes eight. And these are worldly concerns. We want to be liked. It's one. We want to be praised, complimented. When I say it, it sounds kind of funny, but it's not funny. It causes so much suffering, this desire to be liked, this desire to be thought well of, complimented, a smile from someone who we think is important. And we do not like to be criticized. We do not like to be judged. We don't like to be blamed. We don't like to be complained about. Sound familiar? Causes a lot of suffering. Another was, the second one would be extending this kind of same dynamic to groups. I want to be not only liked and praised and included in my group, but I want to be famous. I want to have some power. I want to be looked up to in my group. Whatever group I think is important. And fearing. So these are all of these worldly winds are based on two dynamics, hope and fear. We hope for praise, we hope for fame, we fear blame, we fear disgrace in a group, we fear exclusion from a group. And just to expand just on just even one of these points on the view, to expand on the view of these points. All of our lives, we have sought someone's praise. The faces change. The groups change. But all of our lives, there's been a group or a person in grade school, junior high school, college, early adulthood, middle adulthood, maybe now. The faces change. The groups change. And who knows where those faces are now? They're phantoms, they're ghosts, they're in many cases dust at my age. So we're grasping at ghosts, we grasp at ghosts. And we spend a lot of mental energy on these ghosts. There might be one or two of those in your minds now, or groups. So the other two I'll just say, another one is, But this is all competitive. It's all based on fundamentally, I'm not enough. I'm just not enough. I need to have somebody's praise to tell me that I'm enough. I need to have some group tell me that I'm enough. I need to have some success to tell me that I'm enough. And so it's competitive, because when you think of success, well, what does that mean? That means I'm more successful than, I'm more famous than, I'm more liked than. It's a very cruel, egotistical, inhuman, competitive system that we've created, these eight worldly winds. And it's based on nothing. It's based on ghosts. Because of change. Because the suffering is in our mind. The hope is in our mind. And we spend 1,000 sufferings in our mind. Minutes, hours, much time in our minds with our hope and our fear. And then the moment comes, we see the person. And the person smiles at us. And it turns out to be not that big of a deal, not that much. We have some blush of happiness, some blush of glory from our success or from our fame. But in scriptures, it's described as, it's like drinking salt water. It doesn't quench our thirst. It just makes us more thirsty. So thousands of sufferings for some brief unsatisfactory. Pleasure. The last one is wanting material comfort, wanting money, wanting to go on a nice vacation, wanting a nicer house, a nicer car. Wanting. But they don't really help that much. We might plan a vacation, many hours planning vacation. And we get there, and we're pretty much the same person that we were before we went on the vacation. We still have our 5 senses and our consciousness. So this is view. The 4 noble truths, these are the first and second truths. And when we look at the cost benefit, when we can see the causes of the suffering, see them clearly, this is what I'm doing. I am suffering over this person's judgment of me. I'm suffering over this group's approval of me. I'm suffering over this success or failure. When we see clearly what we're suffering about, when we see the second noble truth, the wisdom, we see this is, if I'm a businessman, a woman, this is not a good investment. From a cost-benefit analysis, the cost, thousands of sufferings for not much, if any, profit. This is not a wise investment. And when we see this clearly, what we're doing, how we're suffering, why we're suffering, when we see through this cruel worldly system, we see how it doesn't work. That we have had thousands of praises in our lives, thousands of successes in our lives, thousands of group approvals in our lives, thousands of criticisms in our lives, thousands of disappointments, and on and on and on. We've experienced these never as any object created a lasting, satisfied self, fulfilled self. Never, no object ever has. We see this clearly. What I'm chasing after right now that's causing me suffering, never has, never will. Work. This is not a workable situation. And by seeing it clearly, we become disillusioned with it. We become disenchanted with it. The enchantment loses its allure. And we become exhausted with it. And cessation comes in. Cessation gradually creeps into our system. I love these two mantras. Who cares? It doesn't matter. Who cares? It doesn't matter. That's the truth. When we can just look at that, whatever it is that we're striving for, whatever it is that we're seeking, whatever it is that we are thirsty for, it doesn't matter. Then the third noble truth is release. We have release. We have freedom. Liberation, which is what we, all of us, so fundamentally long for. This is Buddha's view. It's called right view. The fundamental delusion, the primal delusion, is that we are separate from other beings. That we are the subjects and they are the objects, and we're separate and we need the object to make us enough. So when we have this release, and then we go to meditation, we may experience something else, some kind of another mind, a bigger mind. And there are views about the bigger mind too that we can, that can help us. Views about this release factor that can help us. Science has some profound views about who we are. We are, science says that we're made up of, I don't know if this will resonate with you, but that we are made up of subatomic particles. If we're looked at through a gigantic microscope, we're all made up of the same stuff. Everything is made up of the same stuff. Subatomic particles that are banging around, traveling around at 186,000 miles an hour. That's who you are. That's who everybody is. That's who everything is. so we're not separate. And the subatomic particles are mostly space. They're 99.999% space and 1% matter, 0.00001% minuscule matter. So the matter of these, the subatomic particles is the equivalent of a football, and the space is the equivalent of a football field. So that's a way to describe the third noble truth, the release from the subject object. And this view was amplified in Buddha's second talk on no self, change, impermanence, and suffering. That if when we see that there is no self here, this can be released. Another example of that would be, we call a river a river. That's a river. But when we look and we call ourselves David, okay, I'm David, that's a river. When we look closely at a river, what we see is flowing water. When we look at it directly, what we see is, and the water, it hits up against rocks and it splashes high up in the air. When the river is narrow, it goes very, very fast, like it's called rapids, forms eddies and it comes back. It can be very turbulent, a river. And the banks spread out. The river is calm. So the river is many things. When we look at it at some, if we're looking at it downstream and whether we think, oh, this is a river where it's very calm and peaceful. So there is no river. There is no David. We're constantly changing experience of thoughts and feelings and perceptions and impulses and volitions and sensations. So we can take that view into meditation too. So we have these views, these cognitions. There are more ways to describe, but those are just a few. And we take them into meditation, and we experience the flow of our feelings and our thoughts and our sensations. And if we can let go of our grasping onto the worldly concerns, we can enter into the flow. And we can allow the flow, and we can be the flow. And our hearts can soften and open and widen. And not get stuck. We're not sticking to one of those causes, we can experience some freedom. Our bodies can relax. Our minds can relax. And the mind is not worrying about the future, worrying about the past, worrying about all of these selves that never bring us any happiness. We can be released into some ease, some effortlessness, some kindness, some just natural way. It's like returning home. You know, when you feel at home, when you feel like you can really be yourself. That's how it is. Not caught up in these worldly concerns, but just being able to relax and be ourselves. Be at home. How it feels when I don't know how it is for you, like maybe when you have on your pajamas. And when you feel at home, think about when you feel like, wow, I can really be myself. When can you really be yourself? And that feeling of being myself, is release, is the third noble truth, is wisdom. Wisdom that comes from being free from the grasp. Of the worldly winds, when we give up striving, when we give up effort, when we give up trying to be something, trying to accomplish something. Just relax, simple, relax into ourselves. And the mind calms down. And in meditation, we may experience the mind becoming still or more still. And then like a river, the mind might get some turbulence. But we're gaining in meditation. We're gaining some trust in our at-homeness, in our fundamental ground that is not reaching out to become a self. So if self comes up, we allow it. With an open heart, we allow it. If a face pops up whose praise we want, well, it's okay, I allow it. If an anger pops up, I allow that. The fear comes up. We're not afraid of the fear. We can allow it all. We can allow the whole realm of human experience, anger, doubt, when we're grounded in trust of our fundamental nature, which we can experience in meditation, and we can allow everything. What is more fundamental, more real, what is true. We discover our awareness. Awareness becomes revealed when our mind quiets from all these concerns. And awareness is the heart of meditation. It's essential to all meditations, breath meditation, body meditation, listening to sound, or just open awareness or no object at all. Awareness is the essential point. So more and more we live in this meditative experience and awareness of our being. More and more replaces the grasping mind. And awareness includes everything. Awareness welcomes all experiences. We're aware of bodily sensations. We're aware of mental objects. We're aware of feelings, calm feelings, joyful feelings, loving feelings. And difficult feelings, anger, fear, self-doubt. We just allow it all and we hold it all. Everything is held in awareness. And in the midst of change, awareness is the still point. And this allowing, welcoming, non-judging quality of awareness is kind. It's like we're peeling an onion, or that's not even a good example. It's described in the scriptures as, you know, we're removing the mud from gold. It's like a piece of gold that's covered in mud, covered in dirt. And we're allowing the mud, we're cleaning ourselves of the mud. Or buried, like jewels are buried underneath somebody's house and they think they're poor, but they don't know that there are jewels that are buried in your house. Jewels are often a description of this awareness that we always have, but it's covered in dirt. There's this a Buddha statue in Thailand made of gold, and they were being invaded by Cambodia. It's a long time ago, 16th century, I think, and they covered it in dirt so that they wouldn't know that it was gold, and they would just let it be, and they let it be, and then in the 18th, 19th century, somebody noticed the dirt had cracked and that there was gold underneath. Well, that's us. In meditation, we find our good hearts. And our undisturbed minds, our clear minds, our beautiful minds, just awareness, aware minds. And that's what we take into the world. That's what we take into our conduct. Our our essential nature becomes revealed. It's not like we have to become something. We don't have to create something. We don't have others to depend on others to make us something or some achievement to make us. All we need to do is relax and uncover the mud that's hiding our essential nature, our essential kind nature, our essential awareness is peaceful. Awareness is not subject-object. Awareness includes everything. So if I'm aware of you, rather than seeing you as an object that can somehow validate me or something like that, I see that just you're just like me, that you're identical inside like me, and that you are identically aware, you are identical, and that you have this kindness that may be buried. And just like me, you might be chasing after all the wrong things for happiness, but that you want to be happy. You may be chasing after all the wrong things that you think will free you from your suffering. But just like me, you want to be free from suffering. You have a longing to be free from suffering. When we see this interconnectedness, of all beings, we see that we're all in the same boat. We all want to be happy. We all want to be free. This Zen teacher, Lou Richmond, he's a brilliant teacher, and got some meningitis, some spinal meningitis, and he almost died when he was very young, he was in his 40s. And he struggled with extreme pain and difficulty. And he finally recovered after 6 years. But what he came out of it was, his big insight was, we're all in the same boat. So compassion emerges out of wisdom. Compassion emerges out of insight.